week of September 13th, 2009, this is Showbiz Sandbox, Episode 20, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Amsterdam, Holland, I'm Jay Sperling-Reich.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Karen Woodward.
And at the Toronto Film Festival, I'm Michael Giltz.
That's right, Michael, you're up in Canada at the Toronto Film Festival. I'm here in Amsterdam at IBC, a big broadcasting convention. And Karen, you're in Los Angeles. And I guess I'm getting a little bit of an echo over Skype, and I'll see if I can fix that. It usually takes about 10 minutes for it to correct itself, so please bear with us while I work on that. But in any case, I guess we should start with you, Michael. Tell us how the Toronto Film Festival is going. From everything I've been reading, it sounds really exciting.
It's a lot of fun. It's my first time here. It's a very friendly, easy festival. Con is incredibly stressful, and you just feel like the whole town is focused on it, and getting into everything is sort of, you know, a full-time job. Here in Toronto, it's very easygoing, very relaxed. You just stroll into movies, stroll out again. I've seen everything I wanted to see, basically, and it's a lot of fun.
What have you seen?
What haven't I seen? Well, if you follow me on Twitter, you would know exactly what I've seen. But I've had a good run so far. I've seen, let me go here, I've seen Huacho, an incredibly quiet little movie about a day in the life of poor Chileans, a classic Film Fest movie. People sort of liked it here, but you'll never hear of it again. Dogtooth, which is a weird film that was at Cannes about parents that isolate their children and keep them locked away from the world. It is truly a bizarre, odd film. I saw a George Clooney movie, The Men Who Stare at Goats, which was not very good at all. I saw Nymph, an incredibly obscure Thai film, but for some reason I liked it. I saw City of Life and Death, a Chinese film about the rape of Nanking, which was, you know, a catalog of horrors and noble, but it sort of wimped out on the finale. And then yesterday I had a great day. I saw two really good Hollywood movies. The new Coen Brothers movie, A Serious Man, which I loved, and it's getting good to great reviews. And the George Clooney film, Up in the Air, which I loved, and I hadn't heard anything yet about what other people thought. The people I spoke to were like, well, I liked it. It was good. But I just saw the Hollywood Reporter review, and they gave it a rave.
I'm so excited for that movie.
It's very, very good.
And it also showed at Telluride, and it got rave reviews at Telluride just last week. And now, did you see The Road?
The Road played today at 2 o'clock, and I saw Trotsky, a Canadian film about a kid who thinks he's the reincarnation of Leon Trotsky and tries to organize the students into a union to revolt against the administration. It wasn't successful, but it was sort of a funny, ambitious film and has a very good Ayn Rand joke. But both it and The Road played at the same time, and I had to choose, and I felt like I know I'm going to see The Road soon enough in the theaters, so I chose to see Trotsky.
You know, they showed a trailer for that movie, Trotsky, at Show Canada. And I believe it's a Canadian film that is being distributed by Alliance Atlantis or something, some one of the independent Canadian distributors, and it just looked awful.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't successful, but it was smart. It was ambitious. It was sort of interesting. There were definitely a few funny lines. It was a pretty good cast, some interesting people. It just never rose above that high concept. But it was, you know, it was an interesting, flawed first effort.
Did you see Jennifer's Body, the second film from Diablo Cody, who wrote Juno and won an Academy Award for that film?
No, I have friends who saw it, and most of the buzz was poor. Just, you know, good idea, horror flick from a girl point of view. There's a little sapphic moment, so everybody likes that, at least all the men I spoke to. And this morning I saw a really nice documentary called Waking Sleeping Beauty, which is about the period from 84 to 94 when Disney Animation came out of its slumber and became great again after 20, 25 years, 30 years of being, you know, asleep. And it was made by Disney people, but it actually is pretty pointed. And, you know, with success comes a lot of bitchiness about who gets the credit. And it was fascinating to hear people resentful of Jeffrey Katzenberg and Roy Disney, resentful of Michael Eisner. Everybody sort of wants the credit for what happened. But it was a solid, interesting documentary.
Well, you know, I worked at Disney during that time period, and I can tell you that both Roy Disney and Jeffrey Katzenberg had a heavy hand in all of the animation efforts that Disney underwent. And, you know, I remember when both Roy Disney and Jeffrey Katzenberg came to New York City and in their Park Avenue office in, I want to say it was 1990 or 91, they showed the press Aladdin for the very first time. And they brought all these animators and they really were in charge of that event.
Oh, absolutely. And everybody gave Katzenberg the credit, but Roy Disney felt overshadowed. He was overshadowed by his uncle Walt all his life. and then he became overshadowed by the people that he brought in. He really handpicked Eisner and Jeffrey Wells, who was so key to that studio success, and he's given that credit in the film. He picked them to come into the studio and run it.
Jeffrey Wells?
He went to them. No, not Jeffrey Wells, but what's his name?
Frank Wells.
I beg your pardon.
Frank Wells. The guy who died in the helicopter crash, right?
That's right. And that was sort of that brought it all crashing down, because he was the person everyone went to talk to when they had problems. He was the mediator. He kept all the egos in check, and he didn't have any ego himself, so to speak. But Roy Disney brought in Eisner, brought in Frank Wells. They turned that company around massively and deserve all the tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars they made. And they brought in Katzenberg, and Katzenberg sort of took over animation, and Roy was involved, but Katzenberg got all the media attention. So, you know, he almost could never win. Eisner was the darling, the heir to Walt. Katzenberg became the face of animation, and Roy Disney felt a little bit left out. He's certainly not the bad guy or the only one with sour grapes. Everybody's sniping at each other in the movie, so it's kind of fun. But, you know, Aladdin was when they were hitting their peak. I mean, that was when animators were becoming famous and being interviewed in the press, where, you know, 10 years ago, they almost shut it down completely. They were down to about 150 animators, and they were doing nothing. So it's an interesting, solid movie. Fans of animation and documentaries in Hollywood will certainly be interested in seeing it.
I know that Ann Thompson wrote about it after speaking with Leonard Maltin, and I remember reading her post on it and thinking, wow, that I got to make a mental note to go and see that. Now, you said you didn't see The Road, which is a film that played both at Telluride and at Venice at the Venice Film Festival last week. And when it played at Venice, Todd McCarthy of Variety panned it, and everybody else loved it.
I didn't hear it. Didn't win any awards. I mean, they just announced the awards, and 11 on 1 top film, and you know, so it didn't get any love from the award committee.
I have to say, I think this movie looks just cripplingly boring.
It's based on the Cormac McCarthy novel, which, of course, No Country for Old Men, the Coen brothers film, which won the Best Picture in I Have...
Which I also thought was a...
2 years
really
ago.
Overrated, boring movie.
Or last year.
No, I thought it was good.
It's an acclaimed novel. It's ideal for turning into a film because it's a very simple tale. I'm looking forward to seeing it, but because it also played those other festivals, I just didn't feel like it was going to be discovered here. The reviews I've seen have been mixed to polite, some really strong, but it's not a knockout of the park. It's not a home run as far as critical reviews are concerned. I don't think everybody else other than Tom McCarthy has loved it. I've seen a number of mixed reviews or polite reviews, which are almost worse. If you could say it's a travesty, it makes people maybe want to see it. But when it's sort of like, it's a noble effort.
I'm curious about your use of the word polite. Why bother? To whom? What?
Well, a polite review recognizes that these were people trying to make a good film, that it was a noble effort, and there's no reason to say what a piece of shit about it. They're saying, look, they made a good, valiant effort, they're intelligent people, there's craft up on the screen, it just doesn't work. That's a polite review to me. It's sort of damning with faint praise. Yeah, they're damning with faint praise. They're saying, you know, didn't work. Nice try, you know. It's not often that I feel the need to say that people were, you know, evil for making a film, you know. And you can often tell when they're really trying and shooting for the moon.
Yeah.
I mean, Transformers does not deserve politeness. It's just a piece of junk. But, you know, you make The Road. You have nothing but good intentions. And I got to emphasize.
Let Michael Bay hear you saying that.
And I got to say, to emphasize, the Coen brothers movie, A Serious Man, and Up in the Air, George Clooney, I both think are definite Oscar contenders. And I saw them one after the other yesterday.
I'm so curious to see Up in the Air. I hear that it's like a grown-up movie and that mm-hmm. – that George Clooney's back to being like a movie star, and is it Formiga? I can never say her last name.
Formiga. Yeah, I'm interviewing her tomorrow morning. I walked out to buy the book so I could read it before interviewing Vera tomorrow. And Jason Reitman did a really good job of crafting the screenplay. I'm 100 pages in, a third of the way through the book, and he made a lot of very interesting, smart choices that made it a very strong film and distinct from the book. You know, the book has a very particular tone. And he just made a number of really strong choices. In the book, George Clooney is divorced. In the movie, he's not married. He never wants to get married. I mean, it's just like, heaven forbid he be married. He's not a player. He definitely, you know, is friendly with lots of women all over the country. But he's just not, you know, about to get married. And it works. It's immediately, you can see the smart choices, how he raised the stakes from the book emotionally, how he just really did a terrific job with it.
you know, as Michael, as good as the Jason Reitman film is, George Clooney says he's not going to campaign for an Oscar this year.
That's right. I read that on Showbiz 411 at the Hollywood Reporter. Our friend Roger Friedman interviewed Clooney on the red carpet or solo, I don't know. And Clooney said, just like with Michael Clayton, which also was a very well-done adult film, he's just not going to run that gauntlet of parties. I think it's smart. I think it creates the mystique again of a movie star. Not that you don't want to be available to the Hollywood community, but there's just something about 3.5 months of being in everyone's face and going to every screening and answering Q&As, and everybody knows every answer to every question you've been asked 100 times. It gets a little tiresome, and there's something to be said for just sitting back and letting the work speak for itself. It didn't hurt him with Michael Clayton. He won the Oscar for Best Actor.
Yeah, but you know, there's also something a little self-serving about it as well, because there's something about an actor who's so clearly, you know, pimping themselves out for their Oscar nomination, and then like they don't get nominated, or they get nominated but they don't win, and there's something inherently kind of humiliating about that. And Clooney never puts himself into any kind of situation, unless it's like artistically in a movie, but otherwise he doesn't put himself in those situations.
So you're saying he doesn't put himself out there in a position where he can be shamed, so to speak, or embarrassed.
And it works perfectly with his personality. Like Tom Hanks, he needs to press the flesh, but George Clooney, he's Mr. Dean Martin. He's cool and reserved, you know? I think you're absolutely right. It fits right in with the way we perceive him.
Yeah.
And so we're not insulted by it. If you know, Robin Williams said, I'm above all that. Or, you know, Eddie Murphy with Dreamgirls, he's like, oh, you know, he just expected to get the Oscar. It's like, no, come on. You got to play the game for a while.
Well, especially with Eddie Murphy. I mean, he's kind of a jerk. He should have been very contrite and pitched himself. But Clooney doesn't need to do that. We all like him anyway.
Exactly.
Well, it sounds like you're having a good time there in Toronto.
I am having fun in Toronto. And you said you were in Amsterdam. What are you doing there?
Well, I am attending the International Broadcasters Convention, which is held every year in Amsterdam. 150,000 people attend this convention, and I swear I must have walked at least 60 miles through a convention center here in Amsterdam. The same convention hall, that Cine Expo is held in, which I attended back in June. I'm here to speak on one of the panels. I'm actually moderating a panel on 3D content. And this convention is so big that they have their own daily newspaper. You know, it's the kind of thing where it's all about broadcast equipment, and like I met the guy from Harman International, which makes the microphones that we use to record the podcast, or at least I use, AKG. His name is Thomas Stubix, and he gave me some pointers on how to record certain elements of the podcast. Adobe is releasing a brand new piece of software called StoryNow. It's a collaborative script writing software that I'm looking forward to taking a look at. But there are just tens of thousands of people just milling about on this trade show floor, and it's hall after hall after hall of broadcasting equipment. And you'll never guess what the biggest thing is.
What?
3D televisions.
Oh, I'm not surprised.
And how
to edit. No kidding, really? Does that mean I'm going to need 3D glasses?
Ah, good question, actually. Most of the televisions you will need glasses for, either passive, that don't have any shutter in them, or active, which do. I saw one, what is called auto stereoscopic television. That's a long way off. That's probably at least 7 to 10 years off. And what I love is every single camera manufacturer is here at the Rye in Amsterdam, whether it's Sony or Ikigami or Canon, and they have whole sections and wings of these this convention center where the cameras are set up, and they're, you know, you can shoot different things like a train set or a mountain scene or whatever they happen to have set up that day. But one of the big things are these virtual sets where somebody will stand in front of a blue screen and the set will be built around them. It's a completely fake set. There is no set there. But it looks
People have been doing that for ages.
Yeah, it's kind of like what the weatherman used to do and still does.
And the Daily Show and everybody. But I want to go back to these 3D TVs. Karen, are you going to buy a 3D television set?
No, because I probably can't afford one.
No, but theoretically, would you want one? Would you want to be sitting there wearing your glasses?
No.
Yeah, I would not do it either. Every time I get a 3D movie that comes out on DVD and I have to put on those glasses, it's really such a flat, dull experience. It's much better now at the movie theaters, but at home, I don't want to watch all my television programming in 3D. The glasses are cumbersome. They're a pain, most of them. For 2 hours or 90 minutes, I can do it. But no way am I going to watch. You know how many hours of television people watch? No way am I going to don 3D glasses for all of that. It would have to be.
And what about somebody like me who has to wear my glasses when I watch TV or go to the movies? I've got to put my 3D glasses over my normal glasses?
Same here. That's what we do now. And 3D movies work, but not at home. Not when you watch 60 hours of television a week.
I don't watch quite that much, Michael.
I do.
Well, it's funny you should mention that, Michael, because one of the panels I was in today, that was one of the topics that came up, is that, A, there are no standards set for how to create 3D content for televisions. And before those televisions can become the norm, there has to be some production grammar, if you will, on how to create content for such televisions.
3D television is, it's an idea searching for searching for a market. It's way ahead of people. It's just not where people are at, and I don't see it even for 10 or 20 years easily.
I could definitely see it in the next 10 years. And coming to conventions like this, you begin to see what technology is out there and what technology is out there that allows content creators to create 3D content, and that's actually the panel I'm moderating is about how to create 3D content. And
see, here's the question. To me, and maybe I'm just, a Luddite, but I'm not even really a believer in 3D movies either. And maybe it's just because I go to the movies and I watch TV for the story. I like a good story well told. And to me, 3D and all the hoopla that goes with it and all the action and all the BS, to me, is just that. It's BS. It's a distraction. And that's why I don't go to 3D movies. That's why I don't care. And that's why I would never buy a 3D TV. I don't care.
Well, I would if the technology worked and you didn't need glasses and all that. But I just spent $1,500 on a plasma screen so I could watch my Blu-ray DVDs. I'm a big tech boy. I love toys. I love the new product. A 3D television, and I watch tons of television. I'm getting 3D movies that are coming out on DVD that I can't really enjoy at home. I watch Coraline in 2D, so I understand wanting to have that 3D experience in the home, but I have absolutely no interest in buying a 3D television. None.
Well, believe it or not, you probably have a 3D television. That plasma screen is probably 3D capable and you don't even know it.
Yeah, but it can't be because the standards aren't set yet.
Right, but with the software
and
I'm watching
3D movies on DVD with that plasma screen with the glasses, and it's a very poor experience. It's nothing. It's like 3D movies were 25 years ago when you went to the theater. It's so far behind what happens when you go see Coraline in the movie theater. Coraline on DVD at home is such a poor experience compared to Coraline in the movie theater. It's not even remotely comparable. The technology is so far away to make a good 3D experience at home, and even if you do it, you're not going to watch it for 4 hours a night. I don't want to watch Letterman and Leno and Conan in 3D. It's exhausting.
Well, I mean, why would we bother? Who cares?
Yeah, it's ridiculous. It is really, they have the technology and they think you want it, but they're not. They need to find what people want and deliver it, and they've got the cart before the horse. And I love toys, but they make a lot of mistakes. They get all excited about all the time at trade shows about the new technology, the new thing. Oh, people are going to love this and that. And sometimes they're wrong. And 3D TV is not even close.
Wrong.
Yeah, I agree.
I think there's a lot of isn't this cool? And then sure, people would like this, but nobody ever really takes into account human nature. And oftentimes, human nature just doesn't want those toys.
Well, I can tell you
3 to 4. Mm-hmm.
I can tell you two things. One, we're going to come back to 3D when we get into our Inside Baseball segment. And I can tell you that these broadcasters, or at least these broadcast equipment manufacturers, are most certainly taking human nature into account. With every virtual set and with every camera manufacturer at their booth, I'm sure the old cliche of the convention booth babes, the pretty woman they have cameras that they need to show off. And so they hire these women from around Amsterdam, and I'm not talking about the red light district, but there are these pretty models that stand around in front of the green screen and you know, people can come by and shoot them. And it's very funny watching them all day try and like just stand there and do nothing.
Conventions need to realize that there are a lot more female executives in the world, and they should have some bimbos and himbos as well. Have some good-looking young guys selling that stuff as well.
Well, I will tell you that they are wearing very, very
little. I'm going to be the voice of reason here and say that most women don't need that, because we see right through that. Like, okay, himbo, great, great eye candy, but what are you trying to sell me?
Well, I can tell you that the men certainly stand around next to those cameras when the women are wearing very, very little. And you'd think that they probably could have hired Meryl Streep, since, Michael, do you know Rachel Abramowitz from the Los Angeles
I know
Times?
Her from, I worked with her at Premiere Magazine.
Ah, okay. Well, then maybe she listens to our podcast because she stole your line.
What's that?
In episode 18. This was a really bad segue, by the way.
It was a leap.
You talked about Meryl Streep having legs, and that's what she said. Meryl Streep has great legs or whatever, right, Sperling?
Yes, Meryl Streep's got legs. I was up at like 3 o'clock in the morning. I couldn't sleep. I turned to the Los Angeles Times front page on their website. Meryl Streep's got legs. I couldn't believe it.
I don't think that's a lift, but I think she's telling a different story. When I say she has legs, I mean she brings out the older audience, and it takes a couple, you know, her movies chug along at the box office. She's saying she's a big box office star, which is very true, but I'm referring to how they play in the theaters, and she's just referring to the fact that Streep has had her biggest commercial success of her career in the last 5 to 10 years.
Yeah, I like the way she puts it. Pop quiz. Over the last 3 years, which A-list actress has become a potent force at the box office, starring in a string of films that have taken in almost $1.2 billion worldwide? Is it Angelina Jolie, Reese Witherspoon, Kate Winslet, or Sandra Bullock? If you answered none of the above, then you are probably already clued in to what has become one of the more surprising success stories to hit Hollywood in quite some time. Need a hint? She turned 60 in June. Yes, Meryl Streep. She of the multitudes of Oscar nominations has for the first time in her career become genuinely popular. At a time when most of her female peers have been shoved into early quasi-retirement, and even slightly younger male cohorts such as Kevin Costner and Bruce Willis are shedding commercial viability as far as their hair. As fast as their hair. I've ruined the punchline.
Well, wasn't popular before, but she's certainly having a level of commercial success that's unusual. I don't think the last female star of her age probably is Katharine Hepburn. You know, a woman in her 60s drawing as big as she ever did, it's probably Hepburn. I can't think of anyone else.
Actually, I believe Abramowitz talks about that.
I haven't read the article.
It's an interesting article. And, you know, then there's Lauren Bacall.
Yeah, but it's different. It's like, she might have in her day, but you can't compare her, I don't think, to Meryl Streep and Katharine Hepburn, who were equally as popular in their, you know, 60s as they were in their heyday.
I most certainly wasn't going to try and compare her, but I was going to try and segue into saying that Lauren Bacall, Roger Corman, and Gordon Willis, the cinematographer of such films as The Godfather, I believe, are getting honorary Oscars. The Academy is going to be bestowing honorary Oscars on them, I guess, in February when they hand out the Academy Awards.
No. It's a separate show.
They're
treating it like the Kennedy Center Honors. It's a very good decision. Instead of giving them 2 seconds standing up in the audience or bringing one on stage, they're making a completely separate show that's going to be separate from the Oscars at another time of the year, like in the fall, I think. And they air a tribute to them, an actual good tribute, like the Kennedy Center Honors. I think it's a very smart thing to do. They always got short shrift at the Oscars, or they'd have too many people and it would be boring. And I think a show devoted to honoring the legends, it's a smart way to do it. I mean, though, I'm sure they will acknowledge having given them that tribute at the actual Oscars, but it's a completely separate show that will air separately.
Yeah, are you going to watch that show?
Oh, sure. Well, I mean, people watch the Kennedy Center Honors.
Not.
Well, and that would make you turn it off during the Oscars too, or get bored at that segment, and that's why it's separate, because there's an older audience that wants to see that. Are you happy to see who's get nominated? What about the fact that it's Bacall and Roger Corman and Gordon Willis?
Honestly, I could not care less. I think Lauren Bacall is pretty cool. The other people, I mean, obviously I know who Roger Corman is, but I don't even know who the other guy is. I know. Shoot me, right?
Gordon Willis is a very well-known cinematographer.
He's a cinematographer.
Well, no wonder I don't know who he is.
No, he's one of the legends. He worked with, he did The Godfather. He did all of Woody Allen's best movies. In fact, when Woody Allen went south quality-wise, one big reason is because he stopped working with Gordon Willis, frankly. He worked with, he did all The President's Men, The Godfather Part II, Clute, The Paper Chase, and then, you know, Annie Hall, Manhattan, Stardust Memories, all the early 80s movies, Pennies from Heaven, that's a different movie, Midsummer Night Sex Comedy, Zelig, Broadway Danny Rose, Purple Rose of Cairo. You know, he did all of Woody Allen's.
I hope you're not, like, just spouting these off from memory, because if you are, I'm going to be really scared.
Please tell me you have a list in front of you.
No, Gordon Willis is a huge figure for a really good friend of mine, a screenwriter and director. So I've been very aware of Gordon Willis for years. He'd love to get Gordon to shoot his first feature film, even though he's retired now. But he was there in the heyday of the 70s. You know, he worked with Hal Ashby on his first film. Hal Ashby is probably the greatest director of the 70s. The movie they made was The Landlord. It was not a great one, but, you know, he worked with him. He worked with Alan Pakula. He worked with, you know, Francis Ford Coppola, Woody Allen. You know, he worked with the best, and they did their best work with him.
Well, you
which
know,
is
I
really
worked
telling.
On The Godfather Part 3 as a production assistant.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Well, I was only on set for a couple days, but when I was on set, Gordon Willis, in between takes, would sleep in the chair next to the camera.
That's awesome.
I mean, he was close to retirement age at that point.
He's very deserving. Lauren Bacall is an icon. She got screwed out of an Oscar when she was nominated for the Barbara Streisand movie, The Mirror Has Two Faces, but she lost to Juliette Binoche for The English Patient.
Yeah, that was kind of messed up.
It was a career award that was coming to her, and she didn't get it. So she's well-deserving. I'm just sorry they haven't given an honorary Oscar to Doris Day. Liz Smith, the legendary gossip columnist, has been campaigning for years for them to honor Doris Day. She was the biggest Hollywood star of, like, the 50s, literally. She was a huge radio, recording star, a good TV star. She does lots of humanitarian causes. She totally deserves an honorary Oscar. She's a real talent and the sort that wouldn't get nominated or awarded for the type of movies she made, but is very deserving of Oscar recognition. And it's a shame that she hasn't gotten that yet.
You know, what's surprising to me is that the Academy is giving an honorary Oscar to Roger Corman. And, of course, he is known as the master of the B-movie.
I'm not surprised at all. I didn't mean to cut you off there, but Roger Corman gave a start to practically half the people in Hollywood.
Including Martin Scorsese.
Yeah, oh, no, he let a ton of people. You wanted to direct a movie. You're not going to make any money off of it, but do it for Roger Corman. You'll get to direct a movie and act in a movie and write a movie. You've got a week to do it in, but by God, you'll do it. And the man has like 400 films to his credit. He's made money and given a start to so many people, given them real hands-on experience. I think it's a great choice. It's absolutely deserved and appropriate. He's really, you know, given a leg up to a lot of people. Just the way people on television – like the television talk shows give legs up to comics and music stars and people that they like Ellen DeGeneres, who gave a big leg up to the Jonas Brothers, which is my awkward way of segueing into the fact that Ellen DeGeneres being named the fourth judge, or as I would say, the third judge, Cara DioGuardi is still the fourth judge on American Idol.
Nice.
I was blown away by that. Yeah, they said Ellen DeGeneres is the fourth judge. I'm like, Cara, it's the fourth judge. Ellen is immediately the third, if not the second judge. I was blown away, but Karen, what did you think?
I think it's a horrible decision. I was insulted for Paula Abdul. I was insulted on behalf of the show and all of the contestants. I think it's an awful idea.
Why?
Did you see her on So You Think You Can Dance?
She's not a dance person. She is a pop music person. So I'm.
But she's not a singer. How can she judge their singing?
Randy's not a singer. Simon's not a singer. And arguably, Paula's not a singer either.
2 points, Michael.
Yeah, you don't have to be able to sing to critique a singer. But no, I'm fascinated because you're actually in line with what most people said. I heard it and thought it was brilliant immediately. And then I looked at the reviews and how people reacted. And everybody was either negative or they were like, I don't know. It doesn't make any sense. Or now the show's really jumped the shark. So why such a negative reaction? She's such a likable person.
I don't disagree, but I just don't think she belongs on American Idol. I agree. I think that she I think she's caused the show to jump the shark. I think that she is going to overshadow everything that the show is about. I don't think she knows how to judge without being funny. And this is not stand up. This is not supposed to be about that. And you know, she's already got her own show. I think we don't need her. And frankly, they're probably paying her more than what Paula Abdul is asking for.
I don't know about that.
I would love to hear what her numbers are. I'm sure they paid her a lot. They didn't get her cheap.
I think that's really insulting to Paula Abdul.
Well, it's almost a compliment because they knew they messed up. And I think they did the smartest or best thing they could to try and recover from it. It was stupid of them to dump Paula Abdul. I agree, absolutely. But they hired the most likable woman in Hollywood to replace her, which has to sort of give at least the general audience a little, they're going to cut Ellen slack. They're not going to be gunning for her the way people gun for Deborah Norville after she replaced Jane Pauley on the Today Show. You know, this is Ellen DeGeneres. Everyone likes her. And I don't know if you watch her daytime show.
But this isn't the Ellen DeGeneres show. This is American Idol.
Right, but she's been a huge fan of the show since it began. She's talked about it constantly. She has the singers on her show. She's been on Idol Gives Back. She's had Simon on her show constantly. She's really a big supporter of the show. She's supported pop acts like
the
Jonas
problem.
Brothers.
She represents a real critique.
No, well, Paula did that. Paula was the same way. Paula was always afraid to say something negative. I think Ellen will be more pointed than Paula ever was. 90% of the time, Paula would say, I love you, you're beautiful. You know, maybe you didn't sing the best, but I think you're a bright, beautiful, shining, lovely star. You know,
now,
that was Paula's
biggest...
Can I have
another drink?
Don't joke about
that.
It's
so out of place. If this was going to be, you know, that show where they, you know, judge stand-up people, then she would be perfect. She just doesn't belong here. She's a pop culture critic. She's not...
But she represents
the
fan.
A fan should not be a judge.
Well, you know, Mike Darnell, president of Fox Alternative Programming, was asked by The Hollywood Reporter why they chose Ellen, and he said, she's ideal. She's a huge entertainer. She's funny and witty, and people adore her. She brings all of that to the show.
Yeah, well, we know why you wanted her on the show, buddy.
She loves music. She loves the television show. There was no reason not to do it. She's a huge name. And he goes on to say, he's asked, the main concern of some fans is that she has no experience judging musical talent. And Darnell says, blah, blah, blah. We think that's silly. He's talking about himself in the third person, I suppose.
Me meaning Fox.
Yeah, I know. I just, you know, thought I would throw that in. We already got three judges, which really is not grammatically correct, but let's leave that alone for a second. We used to have... We used to only have three who have enormously long musical backgrounds. She brings something different. She brings her wit and love of music. She has a vision of what she likes and doesn't like. Really, does it matter? It's about America voting. She's going to add a different flavor. That's the whole idea.
Why are you rating it like he's a four-year-old? Because you think what he's saying is so moronic?
No, just because I have been reading certain things in certain trade papers lately and just been going, why are they covering this?
I think that what he's saying is moronic. I think I understand why Fox wanted her. I think it makes perfect sense. Their numbers will go up. But they have completely destroyed this show in terms of what it originally was.
Well, we will see what happens with the ratings.
Oh, the ratings will be fine.
It will skyrocket.
Yeah. People are going to be dying to see her. She's going to hold her own with them. She's going to be a counterweight to Simon. I think she will provide that sort of
protective.
But
she's too nice.
No, Paula was too nice. Come on, Ellen, no one could be nicer than Paula to the contestants. No one ever. Mother Teresa wouldn't be as nice to the contestants as Paula was. Ellen has said already, she said, no, you know, I'm going to critique. She said, I'm not there just to say nice platitudes about people. You know, you can do it in a nice way. You know, you don't have to be mean about it. And if Simon's mean, I'll say he's mean. But she's very sharp. She's very smart. She's funny. She'll provide good back and forth on the judging table. And it is part entertainment.
But it's not going to be serious. It's going to be her stand-up.
Well, no, she's not there to make one-liners. But, you know, you can't predict.
Wait a second.
No, remember, no. This is a family show.
Sorry.
We don't want to be pegged as adults. But no, it's you know, the judges' chemistry and back and forth, it's always hard to replace somebody and see how they'll all bounce off each other. But
We won't know until they get together, but I think she's going to provide a really good counterbalance. And I think she's really good for the mix. I think I thought it was brilliant. She's so likable. She's I don't know if you watch her show, you know how huge a fan she is and how she pays attention. And every fan in the audience thinks they would do a good job judging. I think I would do a good job judging. I think you would do a good job judging.
I'd
would
be
say
terrible
smart,
judging.
Intelligent.
I shouldn't judge that show.
Oh, why not? I'd be great at judging.
No, and I believe I don't know enough about like notes and pitchiness, and I don't know anything about that. I know what I like. I know enough that I can sit here and I can judge them on this show, but I don't know enough to be a judge on American Idol. No way.
Well, you know what? I know what I like, and it sure as heck is not American Idol.
Well, there are hundreds of thousands of fans every week who blog endlessly about the show and give their critiques of every performance and the outfits that they wear and how they present themselves and the things they say and the song choice and the pitchiness and all that stuff. There are millions of fans who do that every single week, including me. And I think Ellen DeGeneres is a really smart, good one. She's a huge fan of pop music. She's been a big fan of Jonas Brothers from the beginning. She saw their talent early on. She had them on when they were nobody. She plugged them endlessly. She's plugged other people. She loves the show. She's had a lot of the contestants on. She's really smart about the show. I think she's going to be great.
So you see her really as more like a voice for the fans?
I see her as just like everybody else who has an opinion about the song that they chose, how well they sung. I don't need to be a vocal coach to know whether I thought someone sings well. I mean,
yeah,
I review
the only
pop
reason
music.
Why she's entitled to an opinion is because she's famous. I just don't understand.
But it's like saying Letterman or Leno, you know, the people on these shows book musical acts and they choose people to support and they help their career. Letterman does it with comics and other people, and these talk show hosts also do it with music. And Ellen DeGeneres has shown good taste in music and the people that she wants to support, both Idol and the Jonas. She's really was a part of the Jonas Brothers success story. I don't know if you realize this, but she really plugged them early and often on her show and has them on constantly and really helped build them into an act. I mean, she was you know, I think they would give her definite credit for being part of the reason they became such a big hit that they were.
Are you saying that that's a benefit? Because I'm thinking that might be a reason to cancel the show.
I think the Jonas Brothers are talented. I thought their last album was one of the best of the year. Certainly one of the best pop albums of the year. Absolutely. And you probably have never listened to it.
I will actually admit I have never listened to the Jonas Brothers.
Well, that's nothing to be proud of. People make fun of the Monkees, and then 30 years later they say, oh, they did a lot of good singles. These guys write their own songs. They produce the album. They write, they perform, they produce. They're very talented. They have some really good pop singles.
I agree. They're exceptionally talented. Yeah. They really are.
Yeah, they're not a great artist yet, but they definitely have talent, and they have charm to spare, and you know they could absolutely have serious long careers. I'll be shocked if they go anywhere. You know, they're gonna produce some great music. And
speaking
they've already
of people
really
who have had
singles.
Long careers, you know, we talked about the Beatles last week. They sold 235,000 CDs in 2 days.
Well, Karen, if I know you have to go soon, but try taping Ellen's talk show for a few days. I don't know if you ever watch it. She's really good. She's really charming.
I love her show.
Oh, my gosh. Okay. Well,
I love her show, and I love her. I just don't think she belongs on American Idol. We're going to have to agree to disagree.
All right. Well, I know you have to go, so have fun.
Thank you.
I think we only have a few stories left anyway. This is going to be a quick one.
Try and carry on without me.
You know, I don't know if we're going to be able to do it. Okay, that was a joke. You can laugh later.
Okay. I'm like, I don't know. Up to you guys.
You know, I think she's really upset about the whole Ellen thing. I think Karen, I don't know how Karen's
no,
going to continue her day.
I look forward to debating this.
Yes, you know, I can't wait. It'll be a lot of fun.
Well, before you go, Karen, quick question. Today's September 13th. Well, it's the week of September 13th. We're recording a day early because everybody's traveling. But September 14th is coming up pretty darn quick. You going to be watching Jay Leno?
Absolutely not.
So is that a hard no? Because didn't really.
That's the hardest no ever. But I will definitely be paying attention to the reviews and the numbers.
What if it was in 3D?
Even worse. Do I want to see Jay Leno of all people in 3D? Are you going to watch it?
Absolutely.
You really? You are?
Oh, I've taped it. I mean, I'm in Toronto.
I'm going to watch it just so that I can debate with you, okay?
Absolutely.
Next week, okay, grudge match.
Yeah, Sperling, you have to remind me that it's on.
great. Karen Woodward versus Michael Giltz. Subject, Jay Leno.
Yeah, well, everybody come
forward. Have fun.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
Bye-bye. I have to admit, Sperlin, you don't care about Idol. I'm really surprised about the negative reaction to Ellen DeGeneres. I've always thought half of Idol was the fact that regular fans got to choose who went forward and who won. And so having someone on the panel that's a regular fan makes sense to me. But, you know, I'm a fan of popular music. And there was a time when the Beatles were dismissed as just, you know, a silly pop band. So,
and now, in two days, as I just mentioned, they sold 235,000 records. And I'm sure
that's not
235,000 box sets.
That's not box sets. That's actual. When they sell the mono box, which has 12 CDs in it, they count that as 12 sales.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that.
It's a whole new world. It's dumb the way they do it now, but that's how they do it.
When
they say the box set goes gold, if it has 10 album CDs in it, that means it's sold 50,000 copies, not 500,000. So it gets very confusing, actually. But yeah, I know they sold 500,000 to 600,000 copies. I'm thrilled. I'm in Toronto, and everywhere, every record store has Beatles memorabilia, and the music is pouring out of the speakers, so I love it because I'm a fanatic for the Beatles.
Well, I know last week I spoke to you in the middle of the week, and you were running off to buy the mono box set. Did you get it?
I did. Trying to get it in advance and order through Amazon, it fell apart. And I went to my local records, an actual local record store in a college town, and said, if you get an extra copy, I'm dying to get it. The guy called me back the day it came out and said, someone else just turned it down. Do you want it? I'm like, yes. And I went in and I ran in and gave him the money and got it. And he said, yeah, I was going to sell it on eBay, but, you know, it's only going for $50 over, and I'd rather give it to someone who really cares and wants it. I'm like, oh, my God. Thank God you didn't sell it. I went home, I ripped it immediately, and I drove to Toronto.
What I love is you ripped a mono box set.
I mean, well, so I could listen to it in the car.
Right, but it's supposed to be like remastered so that the audio quality is better, and then you rip it, reducing the audio quality.
You don't know that I did. I could have done lossless audio ripping, of course.
Touché.
But I didn't. And and the mono set ripped onto MP3s, put onto my iPhone, plugged into a car via a cassette deck connector because it doesn't have a plug for the iPhone.
So and it's then played, just like 1962.
No, absolutely. And played through Tinny's cheap speakers, and it sounded unbelievable. I mean, my head exploded. I drove the entire trip listening to their albums in order, and my head is exploding because it's like hearing the Beatles for the first time. This is the way the music was heard in 1965 on the original LPs. The cassettes I bought as a kid, the CDs I bought 22 years ago, they're different mixes. They're literally vocals come in at a different point in the song. The song, the takes are different. The approach to the song is different. I mean, the White Album is radically different. And it's like seeing Casablanca and suddenly they're saying, oh, no, that scene comes first. And then there's this other scene and there's another actor in it you never saw before. And there's new dialogue you haven't heard. I mean, my head is exploding and it is so unbelievably good. I mean, the Beatles are just, they're amazing.
Well, they've been around for, you know, 60-some-odd years. No, not 60-some-odd years. It can't be that long.
40.
You know, give or take 20 years.
No, they are gods. They are literally rock and roll. It's the Beatles and Dylan, and everybody else is secondary. Their music is so unbelievably great. Once you hit Revolver, it's just, it takes off. It is so unbelievably fresh and original, and still so mind-blowingly good that it's just, and really, it is literally like hearing it for the first time. I feel like I'm finally hearing the music that they created in the studio, the music that they were listening to when they said, yeah, this is what we want to put out on album. That's what I'm finally hearing 40 years after they put it out on LP the first time. And it's great. I can't recommend it highly enough. The Beatles box set on mono, I haven't seen the stereo one yet, but the mono is packaged like an Apple computer product. It is packaged so beautifully. It was a pleasure to open. I mean, it really was a joy to open. I was like, I love everything about this box set. It's just, it's compact. It's beautifully done. It's thoughtful in every detail. It's just great. And never again will we see it's like, because from now on, it's going to be all digital.
Well, I mean, certainly sitting here in Amsterdam at a broadcaster's convention, if I see one more booth that touts the digital workflow and digital asset management, everything is digital. As a matter of fact, when I went to film school, I worked in the post-production facility, and everybody had to edit their 16mm films on flatbed editing machines using actual film, actual celluloid. The machines they edited them on were called Steenbecks, which was the main rival to Moviola, which was the American company, and Steenbeck was the European company. So everybody had either a four-plate or a six-plate, and some people even had eight-plate Steenbecks where they would edit their films. Well, today I walked past this little tiny booth, and in it was Steenbeck's booth. It was a little tiny booth, and they actually had film going across one of their flatbed editing machines. And all I could think of is, you know, 15 years ago, these guys were probably in the center of the room with a huge giant booth, and they haven't changed one bit. They haven't made any effort to change. Instead, who's in the middle of the room? Avid, Adobe.
That's like, I love that they made you edit on a flatbed. Today, that would be like saying if you want to write computer software, you have to use an abacus. Start with the abacus and work your way up. Well, you know, music has gone digital and movies are going digital. I suppose it's only a matter of time before every movie theater in the country puts their, you know, giant reel projectors out on the street as well, because, you know, it's only a matter of time before they switch to all digital.
Well, as you know, that's the industry I work in. That's the technology I work in.
Yeah, and that technology makes sense, unlike 3D TV. But, you know, people are still going to the movies more than ever, and more and more often they're seeing digital presentations.
Yes, indeed. Well, especially when it's 3D.
Like The Final Destination. How did that do at the box office this week?
That's a darn good question. Now, of course, we're recording on Saturday because you're in Toronto and I'm in Amsterdam, and this was almost the podcast that did not happen. After 5 trillion emails and all of the technical difficulties that we had trying to get the recording started today. Let's see here. The Final Destination came in, well, on Friday, made
$1.7 million on Friday, I believe. But
yes,
it looks like the estimate for the weekend is another
$5.3 million.
You know, once Friday's happened, you have a good estimate for what the weekend's going to be. So if you go to box office profit on Saturday morning after noon, after 12 or 9 a.m. L.A. time, you pretty much know what movies are going to be number one for the weekend.
Most distribution executives that I work with, who are, of course, are all with, you know, one studio or another, all know Friday afternoon, Friday night, how much the movie is going to make over the weekend based on how much it's making at that moment. And they're beginning to get hourly grosses in. Of course, with movies like, not Borat, what was the other one? Bruno. And Funny People, where it drops drastically from Friday to Saturday, that's beginning to throw them a little bit.
Yeah, well, movies have always had bad word of mouth from Friday to Saturday if they're really bad, so that's nothing new, but they get so confident in their projections because they're so often right that they do get surprised when something has exceptionally good word of mouth or exceptionally bad. They forget that, you know, people actually have to decide. Even though on Friday at 4, they think, aha, I can do, you know, the new Tyler Perry is going to make $22 million over the weekend. People still got to, you know, make that decision.
That's right. The new Tyler Perry movie is called I Can Do Bad All By Myself. It's been released by Lionsgate. It's new this week. It made $8.5 million on Friday on just over 2,200 screens in North America. And you're right. It looks like the weekend estimate is somewhere between $22 and $24 million. Another new movie opened this week. Focus Features 9, which is an animated film. I believe Tim Burton produced that film.
That's right. He helped usher it in. The guy who made the film made a short that got nominated for an Oscar, and then people saw it and liked it and helped develop into a feature film. And Tim Burton sort of lent his name to the guy. But, you know, I really didn't like the short. I would like to see the film. I'm here in Toronto, so I haven't. But it looks interesting, but it seems like it's visually fascinating, but perhaps a little dramatically inert is the basic tenor of the reviews that I read. And it made $9.6 million, which is perfect.
Wait a second. It made $3.3 million on Friday.
I beg your pardon. I'm looking at the projections for the weekend, and Box Office Profits predicts $9.6 million for the weekend, which is 9, and then 9 flipped upside down as a 6. So, you know, it's released on September 9th. Its movie's called 9. It makes $9.6 million. It's all perfect.
Well, and Inglourious Basterds, Quentin Tarantino's latest film, and, of course, Weinstein Co.'s the savior of Weinstein Co. so far, $1.8 million on Friday, and an estimated weekend gross of $6.4 million.
Which should make it just about ready to pass Pulp Fiction as Quentin Tarantino's top grossing movie of all time.
And despite the fact that this movie has done so well, the Weinstein Company laid off 10 more employees last week.
Well, yeah, you know, no one movie can save. Typically, no one movie should be able to save or destroy a studio. There's lots of other problems if that's the case. You know, if you blame Heaven's Gate for destroying United Artists, a lot of things happened before that movie got made. So, you know, the fact that this movie is not a disaster financially, that it's going to make money and is a good movie and will do well worldwide, it's not changing the fact that they've been a little overextended and stretched themselves too thin and just had too many employees working for them.
Well, they're also releasing The Road, which is we talked about earlier. They were going to release it in October. They've moved it to November 25th, Thanksgiving weekend in the United States. And so I guess they're really gunning for awards season with that film.
Well, that's the only thing you can do with The Road. But certainly nothing says a happy Thanksgiving movie like a post-apocalyptic downer.
You know, speaking of a downer, Maura Tierney, did you hear about what's going on with her? She's, of course, she's the actress that starred in ER.
And News Radio.
And News Radio. And she was going to be starring as one of the main characters in Parenthood, based on the Ron Howard movie. Of course, it's a spinoff of the Ron Howard movie, which was from 1989. And she was going to star in it. I think she was one of three leads. And she had to drop out because she is battling breast cancer. And the shooting schedule interfered with her treatments.
Well, you know, you gotta put your health first, and you know, it's she's probably very lucky. She has health care. I'm sure she can afford the best doctors in the world. Hopefully, they found it early enough, and she'll have great treatment and be able to get healthy again and go back to work. Breast cancer, if you catch it early, is a really treatable disease, and I hope and trust they did that with her. And but it's still a tough battle, no matter how positive and how much better the prognosis is over the years. The earlier you catch it, it's still cancer, and it's still something you got to fight. So, you know, obviously, you wish her the best and hope that she'll be around for many years to come to act in other things.
Yes, indeed.
Losing a sitcom will pale in comparison to surviving and beating cancer, I'm sure.
Yeah, it does kind of seem like that show Parenthood is cursed in a way. I mean, this was the show where an NBC executive died on the set of what appeared to be a brain aneurysm. And then it got delayed until mid-season. And of course, now, and it was delayed because of Maura Tierney's illness, and now she's not even able to participate.
Well, it's not a curse if she found her breast cancer early enough. That's a good thing. So
that is
hopefully,
true. You're absolutely
so
right.
So hopefully, it's a good sign that she found it, knew about it, and stopped it before, you know, and hopefully can fight it early on and take the steps now. So perhaps it's not a curse, but a blessing.
That's true. Unfortunately, somebody else did succumb to cancer this week, which kind of brings us into our inside baseball section of the podcast, and that was Army Archer. He had a rare form of mesothelioma cancer, thought to be a result of his exposure to asbestos in the Navy during World War II, according to Variety. He was 87 years old, and he worked up until July. He was, now, for those of you who don't know who Army Archer was, he was one of the first writers to really, well, he wasn't one of the first writers, but he was a big Hollywood columnist, and he worked for the trade publication Variety. He had a column called Just for Variety. It appeared every single day, and it basically went through all of the news that, it wasn't gossip so much as it was
no.
interesting news about celebrities and executives and politicians sometimes. And, you know, he was a very well-respected journalist. He was the person who first broke the news about Rock Hudson having AIDS, and he did so in a very respectful way. He also kind of, at times, went to battle against Charlton Heston regarding the NRA. Actor Charlton Heston, of course, was the head of the NRA for some years. And he also kind of spoke out about the Academy giving Elijah Kazan, the filmmaker, an honorary Oscar back, I want to say it was 1999, and he just was dead set against it. Elijah Kazan was one of those filmmakers that helped start the blacklist by naming names.
I wouldn't say he started the blacklist. He testified before the
yes.
WAC committee, you
yes.
know, like I believe Frank Capra and others, but... Yeah, no, Army Archer, though that catalog of stuff that he's sort of sticks out in his career doesn't really capture him because he was not a dig-up-dirt journalist. And so his breaking of the Rock Hudson news was sort of an anomaly. He really was, like you said, a person who sort of shared information. He was sort of like the corner guy you would chat with at the drugstore who knew the latest news. He always knew what was happening, what was going on. And he wasn't trying to – he would take a stance on issues, but he wasn't trying to dig up dirt or get enemies. He was just a guy who shared the latest news with you, and a really, you know, he knew everything first, and he was there with little tidbits, little information, sort of a very old school industry gossip columnist, sort of like, you know, Ed Sullivan was in his newspaper column. They were sort of, they championed people they liked and things that they really admired and respected, rather than sort of just trying to dig up private lives or feed vendettas against people they didn't.
Yeah, and of course, he was known to have a huge Rolodex.
Yeah, he knew everyone. He's sort of, Liz Smith is still sort of in his vein. I always think of her that way. She deals a little bit more with just celebrities as opposed to the industry, but one of those journalists who just sort of promotes the people they like and the projects they like and uses their platform to sort of to talk about the things that they're really passionate about and just to share the latest news. And people knew they could go to them, and when they were giving, you know, if Liz Smith ran it or Army Archer ran it, you know it's true. That's when, or they're going to let you know if they're not sure about it. You know, he wasn't a person that dealt in supposition or rumor. If it was an Army Archer, it was true because he got it from the source and he knew what the deal was. So it's just a very trusted source of information. And
he always checked everything, which is why people like Paul Newman and Johnny Carson and, you know, this is, as I was reading his obituary in the Los Angeles Times, I thought, well, it's kind of sad. You know, one can see why he kind of became less read over time, because all of his friends and all the people he wrote about are either all in their late 70s to early 90s or have passed away. Sidney Poitier was the only person he named as a good friend that was still alive.
Yeah, no, it's true. I certainly didn't scan his column avidly when I subscribed to Variety, because his era probably had passed even then, in the 90s. But he, you know, he'd been around for decades, and I think maybe Roger Friedman, who we mentioned earlier, who's at the Hollywood Reporter, he's more of a pointed journalist, more of a guy who finds out stuff and digs up things. But I think he's sort of in the same vein where he loves to champion things that he's really passionate about and give a platform to people that he respects and is a very reliable source of news, as opposed to who's getting a divorce and who's sleeping with whom.
Well, right. And he's certainly, he was one of the first journalists that was chosen for Entertainment Tonight. He worked the red carpet at the Academy Awards for, I can't remember exactly who, but it was certainly a couple of different outlets over the years. I mean,
I think he covered Wings when it won the first Oscar.
Yeah, well, he was around for over 50 years. His column ran for over 50 years every single day. And yeah. I mean, there were times where he'd go on vacation and they'd do reprints. But his first column on April 27th, 1953, his first column ran. It was titled Just for Variety. And it opened up in the following manner. Good morning, which is how he always started his column. Mm-hmm. Here's the public's answer to the future of 3D. 9 out of 10 want to see more. April 27th, 1953.
And they were wrong.
They were wrong then, that's for sure.
And they're right now in movie theaters, but I've been thinking about it while we talked, and to wind it up, if you think about sports in 3D might make a lot of sense, but sports programming lasts 3-4 hours, 5 hours. You know, people watch sports all weekend long. You can't do that with 3D. You know, and to spend the money to get 3D on your TV just so you can watch the occasional movie in 3D, I just don't see it, because the technology is nowhere near what it's like in the theater. And to me, nobody's going to watch regular programming of television in 3D because you watch too much television a day. People consume an unbelievable amount of TV. I just don't see it being more than a high-end gimmick.
Well,
for many years to come. But maybe it'll take us another 50 years to find out. Maybe 50 years from now, they'll quote our podcast and say, see, Sperling said that 3D TV would work, and now we finally have it.
Things that will never happen. I'm sorry, was this a pop quiz?
I think it could happen when you don't have to wear glasses and many years in the future.
Well, just to finish up on Army Archer, Ann Thompson, our friend Ann Thompson, who is actually up there in Toronto. So if you run into her, say hello.
I will.
Likewise with Roger. She said here of Army, I had the privilege of knowing Army for some 20 years. He was a civilized pro who defined an older, gentler era of entertainment journalism. When he gave up writing the print column at Variety after a record 52-year run, he wrote a blog and kept a loyal online following until he stopped filing daily from his Variety office in mid-July. I salute you, sir. May I carry some of your integrity and gentility with me always. And Patrick Goldstein, who wrote a story on Archard in 2002 for the Los Angeles Times, of course, Patrick Goldstein writes the Bigger Picture column for the LA Times, he says, we became bosom telephone buddies after the article. With Army calling to check in on a regular basis, we talked earlier this summer with Army calling to offer feedback on something I'd written, though feedback hardly does the conversation justice since what Army usually did was offer a 15-minute tutorial on the history of whatever subject I'd touched on. Whenever I wrote a column complaining about the dullness of the Oscars, Army would check in, offer a few approving words, and then patiently explain what the Academy should really be doing to fix the telecast, punctuated with a few anecdotes about some of his favorite Oscar shows from the distant past. I mean, that must have been a lot of fun to talk to somebody like that.
Absolutely. Yeah, Dominic Dunn died recently, and I had a great time talking with him. Very different types of people, but definitely from that older, more glamorous Hollywood era. And I hope we're podcasting right up until a month or two before we die.
What is this with you and death lately? Last week you wanted Here Comes the Sun to be played at your funeral. Now you're making podcasting plans right up until the bitter end?
No, I think it's wonderful that he was filing up until July. I think I just think that's awesome. You know, I hope I can work and be creative and active until you know, who wants to spend the last 10, 20 years of your life quiescent? You know, I want to be going. I think that I'm just inspired by what he did. Maybe I'm just sad because Karen already walked away.
After, you know, basically throwing that last punch about Ellen DeGeneres and then taking off. well, now, while you're up in Toronto, have you seen Stephen Garrett? I know he goes every year.
Absolutely. Stephen comes every year. This is my first year. We went to the Disney screening, the screen of the Disney documentary this morning. We've been seeing each other all day, every day. Absolutely. He sends his best.
Now, Stephen Garrett, of course, is the journalist who, a freelance journalist. He works for Time Out, I believe both in New York and possibly even.
No. I think he's here for Esquire, I believe.
Ah, okay. So this year he's there for Esquire. I know sometimes he works for Time Out. Of course, he owns his own production company that edits and produces trailers for independent films. We've talked to him previously on the show. And if you can wrangle him and tell him to get Ian Burney to give us a call, I'd greatly appreciate it. He is, or I should say was, the curator for the film department at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art. Of course, LACMA closed its film program, or at least made overtures to close their film program before Time Warner and I can't remember who else. It was...
Was it Scorsese?
No, Scorsese wrote a letter after Michael Govan, the head curator and director of LACMA, said, we're closing down the film program in October after the Alain René retrospective. Ian Burney, of course, was the curator for that retrospective. I asked him to come on the show several weeks ago when all of this was flaring up after we had discussed it, and he very politely said, yes, I do remember meeting you, you know, and Stephen introducing us. However, I really just don't want to talk publicly about what's going on. You know, I do have a severance agreement to work out, and I am still consulting for them. Well, in the Los Angeles Times this week, there was a story. Apparently, he's talking now because he talked to the LA Times in what they called an extensive interview. He said that his professional relationship with Michael Govan, his boss, was distant, verging on non-existent, and the majority of the museum's curatorial staff showed little or no interest in the film department during his tenure. Burney was, quote, officially demoted to a contract position with the awkward title of consulting curator for the film department.
Yeah, well, just in general, it's sad that Los Angeles doesn't have a venue that with a stable future that can show classic Hollywood movies the way they're meant to be seen.
Right, they have two people that work in that office.
Right, and that's why this is getting, you know, the attention it's been getting, because it's Hollywood.
Yeah, well, and I think the LA Times did a good job of pointing out that LACMA's skeleton film crew pales in comparison to the film department of the Museum of Modern Art in New York, which employs a staff of about 25 people, including 9 different film curators.
Including my friend Josh Siegel, who is also here at the Toronto Film Festival.
Really?
Yeah,
you he'd get be him a great. On and ask him what he thinks.
Well, he'd be a great one to run LACMA. But the funny quote from Ian Burney was where he said that it doesn't necessarily mean that LACMA will hire him back just because they're sort of waking up again. He said there's been no discussion of that, but they haven't said they won't do it. To which I say, well, now that you've given this interview, I think it's almost a given. You saying you had no relationship with your boss and the whole place hated, was disinterested or hated the film program, pretty much guarantees he won't be back.
Yeah, I would agree with you. And, you know, Michael Govan said in a statement that Burney will be working as a programmer for the museum, quote, through this year while we look for longer-term support.
Yeah, they need money. They don't want to lose money on it anymore. But really, it should be funded by studios and Hollywood directors who realize that this is something that should be done as a public service. There's no reason for $100,000 a year you can't fund an L.A. you know, classic film program.
I agree with you.
It's
well,
very
sad. And he wants to increase the budget from $350,000 to $500,000 a year. And he, in this instance, is, you know, Govan wants to increase
yeah.
the budget. I mean, quite honestly, I look at this as the guy really messed up. And he canceled this film program. He didn't think anybody would notice or anybody would care or anybody would say anything. Or if they did, it would die out quickly. And he really just stirred up a hornet's nest. And now, he raised $150,000 to keep it going until June of next year. And, you know, he's playing the hero here as if, you know, he's going to, you know, revive the film program. Well, it never should have been killed to begin with. He should have figured out some other way.
Well, there may have been other ways to do it, but I think it showed the seriousness of the problem for them to say, look, we're going to shut down at the end of the year unless somebody steps forward, and somebody stepped forward, and he obviously didn't have a good relationship with Burney, so, you know, if they can get someone new in and get him a better budget and a bigger staff, they'll be able to actually hopefully make it a going concern and make it, make it actually work. There's no reason why it shouldn't be able to sort of support itself. A lot of museums work in deficits, however, so it's not unusual that you'd have a program that would provide service to the public and yet on a flat budget level, you know, lose money every year. So that's not terribly unusual. But it's LA. It should be able to break even on a film program. But I don't know if he thought it would just happen quietly. I think he did it the way you do it. If he wanted to do it quietly, they wouldn't have said anything. They just would have sort of just pulled the plug, you know, when nobody was looking. Instead, they announced 6-8 months in the future, we're going to shut it down because we're losing money, and it woke everybody up.
Well, on that note, I guess we should probably wrap things up. Karen Woodward, of course, can always be found on Twitter. KWoody3939 is the name to look up, or on industrynexus.com. Michael, you can be found on Twitter, too. The name to look up for you is Michael Giltz, and that is also your website, michaelgiltz.com, GILTZ.com.
Yes? That's right, and if you go to michaelgiltz.com, you can find links to following me on Twitter and Facebook and Netflix and everything else.
And, and you can also, if you go to our website, find links in our show notes to all of the stories we discussed on today's episode. You can visit our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you will find links to all of our social networking accounts, including Twitter, LinkedIn, and Facebook. If you want to email us with feedback or comments about some of the stories that we spoke about, or even corrections, feel free to do so. We will read them on a future episode. The address to email is dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Of course, you can always leave us a voicemail, too. You can do that. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's toll-free, 888-567-7263. Give us a call and let us know what you think of the show or any of the stories we talked about. If you want to send us news stories, one way to do so, besides email and voicemail, is through delicious.com, the social bookmarking website. Just tag any link, Showbiz Sandbox, all one word. And, of course, the music that you hear at the beginning and end of each episode of Showbiz Sandbox is by the popular indie group MGMT. I always want to call them management. You can visit their website at whoismgmt.com or find them on MySpace at myspace.com/MGMT. Anything else to go over, Michael?
Well, I'm filing about the festival every day for Huffington Post. So, you know, search for me online there or the front page of the entertainment section. I'm there every day giving my latest reviews and coverage of the events here.
I look forward to reading your review of Trotsky. Until next week, play nice.